This episode of Ghost Stories is brought to you by Satrix, the leading provider of index tracking solutions in South Africa and a proud partner of Ghostmail. With no minimums and easy, low-cost access to local and global products via the Satrix Now online investment platform, everyone can own the market. Visit satrix.co.za for more information. Welcome to this episode of the Ghost Stories podcast. It's another one with the team from Satrix. There have been so many of these and they've all been really, really good. I've enjoyed all of them. And today we're going to do something a little bit different. We do try and think of original stuff for these podcasts. Obviously, as our listeners, if you have any ideas of what you'd like to hear from the team at Satrix, you're always most welcome to share them. But what we will be doing this month with Sia Bulela Nomoyi this month round from Satrix is we will be looking at a five-year view on the markets. And of course, what makes that really interesting is, you know, 5 years a pretty common view to look at. If you go into Google Finance, for example, you can typically draw a five-year chart. It's quite common as sort of a long-term view. But what makes 5 years really interesting right now is that 5 years ago, the world went mad. So Sia, we will be looking back on 5 years of life since COVID. It's not exactly 5 years, obviously. It was March 2020 where everything went crazy. But I mean, we're now in May. So that's pretty close for a 5 years since the bottom kind of view. Let me welcome you to the show first, and then we can dig in and see what interesting stats you've got for us, Sia.
Yeah, hi, Ghost, and hi to the listeners as well. Always great to be on your podcast. Second one between us this year. And the last one, I believe, did exactly what it intended to do, educate more people out there. So thanks for inviting me again. Quite excited about this one as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the insights are always great. And I think today will be no different. So let's jump straight into it, which is a look at how we would measure, I guess, just how mad the world can get. So 5 years ago, things got a little crazy. And I know you've done some work looking at major drawdowns, not just in that year, but versus years before that, as well as the years since then, because market volatility is a feature, not a bug. And these drawdowns are going to happen. COVID was just one such catalyst for a drawdown. So I'm quite curious to understand, firstly, how do you actually measure a drawdown? Is it like a peak to trough thing? Over what period? How exactly do you actually measure these things? And then what are some of the data points that you've found particularly interesting, not just in terms of what happened during COVID, but also before and after?
Yeah, look, 5 years ago, Ghost, we watched as the president sent us to lockdown. And I remember waking up the next morning, looking out the window and felt like we were in a sci-fi movie. But look, the finance world did not hit a pause button. With so many things digital these days, but you're absolutely right. There was some form of madness, if I may call it, that resulted in how things were at that point. So just to explain the drawdowns quick, as you've asked, anyone who is invested in any asset class or any asset expects it to actually appreciate in value. So it should grow to a level higher than what they've purchased it. But with asset pricing, you seldom see anything that grows in a straight line up. So there's always price moving along the way, which we call volatility, and you've mentioned at the beginning of the show in financial markets. So when you speak about drawdowns, this is where you measure how much the asset has lost since it hit a certain peak level to where it hits its lowest level. So silly example. So it's almost like a bungee jumping off a bridge. The peak is where you jump off, but the drawdown is an equivalent to the lowest point of how far you fall. And it's very, very important to actually understand.
That's a great analogy, by the way. That's a very good analogy, Sia. I like that. Bungee jumping is exactly it.
Yes. And it's very important to actually understand, firstly, the how far you're going to fall, because now you understand which ones you can actually take in terms of the risk that you want to take. So that part is quite important. Also, once you jump and you get to the bottom, you start to actually go up again. So you appreciate up. So in 2020, when countries went into lockdown, there was a lot of selling of assets, which then pushed down their prices, causing massive drawdowns. In such periods, the riskier asset class is actually classified, the more drawdowns it can have, possibly. And we saw that in 2020 with equities leading the way with some big negative returns. So we saw the China and India equity markets coming off as one of the worst in the equity indices that I looked at. And they actually pulled the MSCI emerging markets equities down with them as well. What was great to see, though, was seeing global bonds being a sort of like a safer asset class as expected in 2020, which they only had like 2% as the worst drawdown during that period, while gold also did better in 2020, having a drawdown of about 10%. And those are up in USD. So what was also interesting was that healthcare, sometimes it's seen as a defensive sector, but it also went as far as close to 20% down in 2020. So look, there were many country-focused equity indices that had huge drawdowns that year. UK down 29%. Locally, we hit a 22% drawdown. Many. So it was a brutal year. And what was interesting, and we can speak to that when we further down the show, is that some of the country-specific equity indices were sort of like going the same direction in terms of returns before 2020, but there was some divergence that we saw from 2020 and also after that. And we can speak about what happened there.
Yeah, I mean, it's mega interesting. So you shared some of these stats with me before we actually did this podcast. I had a look as well. And some of the stuff that stood out for me is, you know, you've mentioned emerging markets there. China, way more volatile even than India. So that kind of shows you as well, that's emerging market risk coming through essentially. And what's also quite interesting is the all share index, generally speaking, not always, but generally speaking, is actually less volatile than India, less volatile than China, even though we're an emerging market and we all fall under BRICS effectively. But I think a big part of that is because of gold. I would wager that the amount of gold exposure in the JSE all share actually helps us, because gold ends up being subject to larger drawdowns than maybe the dollar, for example, as the sort of safe haven currency, but definitely less severe drawdowns than equities, which again is what you would expect out of gold. So I think that actually, it almost bakes a little bit of resilience into the all share index, which is quite interesting. And one final observation that I just wanted to make was, if you look at the S&P 500 versus the NASDAQ 100, and the NASDAQ obviously a very tech heavy index, if you have a look in 2020, the NASDAQ 100 drawdown wasn't as bad as the S&P 500. And I think that's because the market realized, okay, if everyone's going to have to, you know, stay home and stay safe, then these tech companies are going to benefit from that, certainly much more on a relative basis than some of the traditional industries. But if you then have a look at the period subsequent to 2020, the worst drawdown in the NASDAQ 100 was significantly worse than the worst drawdown in the S&P 500, and that's because the NASDAQ was then drawing down off a very inflated level. So what this really shows you, it's a measure of risk, but it's not a measure of returns over time, right? This doesn't tell you anything about how these things have performed over 5 years. It's just telling you how strong your stomach is going to need to be along the way. Is that a fair statement?
Exactly. That's why I was saying at the beginning, is that you actually need to understand the risks that come with the, whether it's an asset type or a sector that come with that, because at a certain point, it's going to hit some drawdown, and you need to understand why that's happening and how far that actually can go and what to do at that point. So definitely, when you're looking at these different indices, they are showing you how far they can actually go, depending on what period you are in and which ones have been a bit safer when you compare them between each other.
So if we then look at the actual returns, and here what's quite interesting is you can look over 5 years and 3 years. So essentially over 5 years, you're basically assuming that you had the guts to go and buy the dip. Maybe you didn't time it absolutely perfectly in March 2020 and do that Sasol trade that everyone loved so much. But let's say, you know, you waited a couple of months and then you really went for it. Or you just bought 5 years ago, whatever. That was the first time you got in the market, whatever the case may be. The returns over 5 years, given that depressed base, are obviously going to look better than over 3 years. And the way to do this is to annualize the return, because obviously your assumption needs to be, well, if you've been in the market for longer, the market gives me returns on average every year. We know that's not quite how it plays out. So you should have seen more growth over 5 years than 3 years. So when you're comparing a period, it's not about saying, oh, what's the total growth? Because it's not an interesting insight to say, well, it grew more over 5 years than 3 years. You actually annualize the growth, right? To say, well, what is it per year. And so if you're coming off a more depressed base, then your annualized growth is better. But I think if you look over 3 years, then some of the value of investing consistently also comes through. You know, you don't have to pick the bottom. This is something that we say quite often, is you can also just kind of look for good entry points and invest consistently. So what have been some of the insights that you've seen from looking, you know, over 5 years versus 3 years, for example? What stuck out for you?
The crazy part of what happened in 2020, like, okay, let's just go back to, like, everyone sort of like gets into that panic even after gaining 200%, let's say, for instance, previously. I mean, human beings just start to panic when they see 5% drawdowns or 5% a return on their asset, especially if it's the first time they're seeing that. So this is, it's also interesting that you brought that the term of buying the dip. This is where the whole thing of buying the dip came in, with a lot of social media chanting behind it as well in that period. And I have seen a lot of people being hurt by it, because they're just buying the dip based on just buying it, no further information on what's happening behind that, what the fundamentals are and all those things. So while there have been some proper luck on it, as you say, if you just, maybe you, it was the first time you were trying out investing and you just literally just bought into that March 2020 dip, and you just get those great returns after that. So in 2020, even with those large drawdowns, some of those indices actually recovered even before the year had ended. But what was interesting was the China equities since then, decoupling from the rest of the market, not really recovering, in fact, doing even worse after that as they continued with their lockdown policies and also had other major issues afterwards. But on your point about a depressed base back 5 years ago, definitely there is a huge difference between when you're looking at three-year numbers versus five-year numbers, especially in our local market, with the latter giving you way more. So the differential obviously is also going to be impacted by what has been happening recently as well. But if you look at resources, for instance, locally in annualized numbers, if you just look at the last 3 years, they would have given you -1% per annum if you're holding in that period. While if you extend that, go back 5 years, that would have given you 19% per annum, showing really that depressed base that you are talking about from 2020. Looking at local financials, 10% per annum in the last 3 years, but over 5 years, double that per annum. Same goes for the broader indices like the All Share Index and even the top 40 indices, where in 3 year numbers, in 5 year numbers, they're doubling the returns per annum when you're looking at 3 year numbers. But on the international front, the local investor would also have had influence in their experienced returns from the currency exchange as well. Of course, all our investors who buy the Cetrix offshore ETFs, for instance, know that they have the pricing on them in rands. So it really matters to them how the currency behaves. But on the offshore side, as mentioned, China really did poorly and then just continued to drag while other markets were really recovering in 2020 and onwards. So on five-year numbers, the MSCI China index only did 2% per annum, while on a three-year basis, things look way better, especially with the last 6 months or so, with the index giving investors 12% per annum if you're looking at that period. So one index that has done very, very well, and it speaks to your point about maybe it's not about timing the market, really. So if you're looking at the NASDAQ, which is investors getting 21% per annum through all the turmoil since 2020, which really shows that it's really timing the market, not really trying to time the market. A lot of people say that because even looking at 10-year numbers, the NASDAQ, which is an index that is tracked by one of our offshore ETFs, has done 22% per annum. So very good in terms of long-term investing as well. But both locally and offshore, definitely ghost equities had been strong, while in South Africa, we saw the nominal bonds as well, also giving good returns, while offshore bonds were quite poor on a five-year basis.
Yeah, some observations there from my side. So it says a lot about the South African economy over the past 10 years that the bonds did almost as well as equities. I mean, that is not what should be happening really, especially over a long period like that. And alas, it has been a period of low growth. I think on the debate of time in the market versus time in the market, the classic saying, I think that within any kind of reasonable range of multiples, there's a lot of truth in it, but I think you have to be careful about buying into the big hype. So I'll give you a great example here. Over 10 years, if you skim the list of these FTSE returns, and maybe we can actually include this table in the transcript of the podcast, but the one that sticks out as being very poor over 10 years is the South African Listed Property Index, annualized only 1.4%. Now, I'm guessing that would exclude dividends. That would just be the value of the actual ETF. That's not a, probably not a total return index. So the divvies will definitely help here. But here's the problem is that 10 years ago, you had a situation where the South African listed property market was a bubble. And it was kind of obviously a bubble. I know it sounds like you can say that with hindsight and try and sound clever, but at the time it was pretty clear. Property funds were trading at big premiums to NAV. They were just doing book builds basically every single week. I remember I worked in corporate advisory at the time, and I was quite jealous of the advisors who worked in the property space because it felt like they would just get to work and the money would be made. It just fell out of the trees, basically. They would phone up some instos, do a book build, and away they go. So that's one of the ways to tell when a sector is hot, is have a look at how much capital raising activity there is. It's why people use measures like, oh, the number of IPOs in a market to try and gauge, you know, where it is in any given cycle. Another very good example of this on the table, actually, and this is now on the offshore side, is if you look at India versus China over the past year. So this is just a wonderful example of capital rotation and how profitable that can be. And I would point out that capital rotation is one of the cool things you can do in your tax-free savings account, where you can actually sell out of one ETF and into another if you want to take a more active role. You don't have to, definitely, and it's not for everyone, for sure. And all the usual stuff applies. But if you are someone who wants to get more active, I mean, here's a perfect example. Over 10 years, this is quite a long-term example now, MSCI China has done 6.9% roughly, India 12.4%. So big outperformance there by India. Over 5 years, you referenced China with the lockdowns and how much that hurt them for a while, etc. Horrible over 5 years. China just 2%. India 21.2%. Again, this is both in ZAR. So India has done really well. They have far more of a services economy than a manufacturing economy, which I think has put them in good stead. They get a lot of the outsourced tech kind of stuff lands up in India. So that works quite well. But if you look over the past year, India minus 1.1%. So basically that's just cooled off now. It's kind of plateaued and, you know, the market's saying, wow, this thing is too hot now. Whereas China up 36.4%. So, you know, that again, their hindsight is perfect. Like for sure it is, you know, but it just shows you if you're going to go and buy the big hype stuff. So the MSCI India a year ago or the property index 10 years ago, or arguably some of these tech names now, for example, the NASDAQ 100's only done 3% in the past 12 months in ZAR. Your money was ironically better off in the bank, you know? So there is an element of, you need to be in the market for a long time, absolutely. But timing the market is also important because you need to try and avoid buying the big frothy peaks. And that's why you'll often see professional investors write about, you know, a market is cheap or a market is expensive. Don't ignore that stuff when you're making allocations, because avoiding those peaks actually can save you a lot of pain. And it's not as hard as it sounds. You can see when a market is really frothy.
Absolutely. And just might be a shock to you, but if you're going to be sharing the table with the transcript, Ghost, those returns are actually total returns. So that property, those are total returns. So 1.4 over 10 years. That really just shows the drag in the capital there.
Are those total? Ooh, that's bad. That's horrible. Actually, that makes sense, right? Because so many of those property funds are actually trading below where they were 10 years ago. So the divvies have kind of pulled your total return into the green. Oh, that just makes the point even stronger. So yes, thank you for confirming that. Don't buy frothy stocks. That's the lesson here. Easier said than done, but learning to spot them is an important thing.
100%.
So I think we've now looked at an example of all these different indices and how the performance plays out. And obviously one of the lovely things about Satrix is you offer so many of these indices as ETFs. You really have this breadth of options. It's great. It's so much more than just the top 40, which is really where the business started from an ETF perspective all those years ago. One of the things that's quite interesting as well is instead of just tracking the index that people would be familiar with, like a NASDAQ 100 or an S&P 500, you've also got stuff like factor indices. Now, we've done some work before in this podcast with various people from Satrix, actually, just talking about some of the different types of things you can invest in. But with these factor indices, what has stood out for you? I'm guessing stuff like growth has done well, maybe momentum, just because we've been in that kind of market, right?
Quite right, Ghost. So in as much as Satrix is well known for tracking vanilla indices like the top 40, MSCI World, and so on, you're also quite a strong player in the factor investing landscape, or people may call it smart beta, if you like. In fact, that forms probably 90% of my job, as I mostly manage our different factor offerings in some of our portfolios. But definitely goes to when looking at the offshore markets and compare returns amongst the different MSCI factor indices versus how the actual MSCI World Index has done. Growth has done better than the index, while momentum has also kept up, and even the quality factor has done very well. And just a quick guide to the listeners on these factors, quick reminder. So in the momentum index, for instance, the MSCI would favor an increased weights in stocks which have been performing well, maybe in the last 6 to 12 months, for instance. So hence the word momentum. So they've got price momentum, and favor companies that have good historical sales growth, high forward earnings per share growth rates for the growth index, for instance. And also maybe in the quality index, they will favor companies that have low leverage or high return on equity and so on. So they use these sub-factors to actually increase the weight in a particular stock or decrease the weight compared to the index like the MSCI World, to actually amplify the factor on that index. So that is how they build these factors indices, quite similar to how we would also look at factors, as well as we offer momentum, value, quality, low volatility, and also we also have a multi-factor fund in this space. So if you think about all the sub-factors on those momentum, quality, and growth I was talking about on the offshore side, the connection would have been Infotech there if you look at the holdings of these three factors. So definitely these indices had been overweight Infotech, so which is why they have been doing very well in the last 3 and 5 years. And the factor that actually lost out the most is in the last 5 years or so is perhaps unsurprisingly the low volatility index when compared to the MSCI World Index. So the last 5 years were really not rewarding non-risk takers. You had to be in it to win it. So you had to be on the high volatile and much riskier stocks to actually extract performance and do better than the market. So on taking more risk in the last 5 years, you would have been rewarded more because you would have probably picked those high growth stocks and actually get a way better return versus the index.
I'll tell you what stands out for me on that table is just how well the momentum index does. But just across periods, so you look over 10 years, 5 years, and 3 years, and it's pretty much comparable to stuff like the quality index, which you would understand and you would, you know, that would make sense. But then you look at stuff like over the past year, and you've got the World Quality Index has done 5.9%. It's not terrible, but the Momentum Index 15.5%. It's kind of just, you know, carried on almost as the name suggests. So it just, if I look at all of that, it feels like the momentum index really is the one that has been a very strong performer. The other one that's interesting to take note of is the high dividend yield index, which hasn't been great over 10 years. I mean, it's not been bad. I guess it's just compared to some of the others, it's a bit down. And I guess we've been in a world where companies have been rewarded for reinvesting. Obviously, the high dividend yield stocks are the stocks that are trading on quite a low valuation. So there's quite a bit of overlap there, I guess, with stuff like the value index, which has struggled. You know, these are companies that are not necessarily reinvesting their capital. They are older school, mature businesses. They are the cash cows. They are basically, you know, just trying to grow with inflation and then pay out big divvies. We've been in a world that has really rewarded growth and risk-taking, to your point. Lots of tech, etc. Will that be the case for the next 5 years? There's no way of knowing for sure. And that's always why diversification is helpful. You know, I have a mix of dividend payers and some growth stocks and everything else. But yeah, the momentum index really stood out for me there. I think my key takeout from this might be to go and do some more research actually on the momentum tracking ETF. I want to go and learn some more about the constituents there and sort of how that momentum is actually calculated and the fact that it leads to it. So I feel like there's an upcoming show in this, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. We can do that. I think it would be a very nice educational piece on factors, because they matter in terms of not only just when you're trying to diversify between asset classes, when you're going to equities, there's also different ways to actually diversify, whether by sector or the kind of factor that you want to pull in. So you've got indices that will do the work for you. And if it's currently a period where momentum is, or growth is doing well, then your portfolio probably might do better. So might be interesting for your listeners as well.
No, absolutely. So I think let's move on to fixed income. We got to touch on bonds a little bit. We did a little bit earlier talk about some of the bond returns, but traditionally when people talk about bonds, they generally mean it in the context of correlation with equities. And there's that whole school of thought around a 60-40 portfolio to try and just smooth out your returns over time. But the problem is that if bonds become highly correlated with equities, then that diversification actually, it doesn't work. It's not achieving its stated goal. You know, all you're doing is you're now having two asset classes that move together as opposed to two asset classes with low correlation. And I found it interesting. I looked the other day for a piece that I wrote, and the S&P 500 and the US 10-year bond yield were both almost exactly flat year to date this year. So despite everything that's happened out there, you've got bond yields in the US on the 10-year sitting pretty much flat year to date. Lots of volatility, but back to where they started. S&P 500, same story. Now, that doesn't suggest that these things have low correlation. It's clearly they're quite highly correlated. But what is the data telling you over longer term views, et cetera? You know, what's your thinking around this bond versus equity debate?
Yeah, I guess I could say, I mean, one of the long-term injuries that came off from 2020 would be this change in the dynamics of bonds and equities. Certainly, it's been a bit of a tough job for managers who tend to mix the two asset classes along with other asset classes as well, especially on the basis of low correlation and hence diversification in bond and the bond market also offering a lower risk profile than equities. So just for the benefit of some listeners who might not understand the term correlation. So in finance, I mean, correlation describes the statistical relationship between the movement of two asset classes or more. So you can check the relationship and see how often they actually move together or they move opposite direction. So it measures how strongly and what direction those assets tend to actually move together. So we would have a measure between -1 and 1, and 1 being the perfect relationship. So if one asset class is going up, the other one is also going up at the same time. So perfect relationship with 1, and then -1 would be they go in opposite direction. So 1 is positive, the other is negative, and so on. And sort of like 0 indicates no correlation at all. There's no relationship that you can't determine what's happening. So before 2020, though, the correlation numbers fluctuate a lot. But if you look at global bonds and you measure the correlation between that and the MSCI ACWI index, which is an equity all country index, the correlations were swinging between 0.2 and 0.4, which is quite an accepted low correlation measure. And that was before 2020. But since then, and if you remember when we were talking about the drawdowns, when we were speaking about the equity markets down 20-30% in 2020, while the bonds were like down 2%, which is indicating that the correlation is quite low there. And you wanna have that sort of like mix of assets where one has a lower profile in terms of risk and the other one has a higher profile in terms of risk, if for instance. So since 2020, since then, there has been this consistent climb in bonds and equity correlations. And there is always this term of bonds giving equity-like returns being said in the market. And indeed, that has been the case. And since 2022, which is where anyone felt the high drawdowns, both from the equities and the bonds, something that has not happened in decades, where if the equities are going down, the bonds are also going down at the same time. The correlation have shot up between the two asset classes, and now they average about between 0.6 and 0.8, which is very, very high. for those two asset classes. So historically, if you would look at 2 to 3 months rolling returns between these two asset classes, there were a lot of periods showing negative correlation, which would mean that they go opposite direction in terms of returns. So talking to the diversification relationship we know of, but that has ticked up a bit. So as I mentioned, about 0.6 to 0.8 or so in the last couple of years. And if you remember, Ghost, in 2020, we had central banks cutting rates on every single meeting. In fact, locally, we even had emergency meetings, right, in South Africa. But after that, especially in 2022, central banks started to actually being quite aggressive in terms of rate hiking, which pushed yields up massively. And I think the 10-year you just spoke of went from 0.7 beginning of 2022, and the same year it shot up to about 4.5 by October of that year. And from our fixed income show we know what happens when to bond prices when the yields rise. But then now at that very point, the number crunchers running quantitative models on stocks now using a higher discount rate from the fact that the interest rates have been pushed up, suddenly re-rating stocks, and the market started selling and sending the equities to negative territory, at the same time as the bonds were down. So that really sent those two asset classes down. But real yields can hit the stock market, but more especially growth stocks, which is where we have seen a lot of market volatility this year. So investors and your listeners must always keep watch of what's happening in the bond market, even if they don't hold any bonds. In fact, last night I saw a tweet saying stocks cannot destroy bonds, but the bond market can certainly destroy stocks, which I thought was quite powerful.
That is powerful. I like that. So while you were talking now, I did a quick 5-year chart on that 10-year. So yeah, 0.5 in 2020, all the way up to nearly 5% in, October 2023. And that, of course, is what obliterated some of those tech stocks, at least in terms of that huge drawdown. That's as we started the show and we talked about some of those big drawdowns in places like the NASDAQ index. It's what happened there with bond yields. So all these things are connected at the end of the day, which is why it's important to try and understand as many of them as you can. Of course, the other thing that came from low rates as we bring this podcast to a close is the rise of the retail investor. They were fueled by the beautiful low interest rates, but also by a willingness to learn about the market. And I think just having access to so many resources to facilitate that learning as well. That's really been a feature of the past 5 years or so. And I started the Finance Guys 5 years ago. So that was more just luck than design, to be honest with you. But it was just one example of the sort of information that people suddenly have access to. What are the stats telling you in terms of the rise of retail investors?
So Ghost, I mean, this part is quite interesting to watch. So, you know, we went from being people who were outside a lot of the time, and then suddenly in 2020, we were locked inside our houses. And some people actually used that as to learn new skills, and it took advantage of digital tools that they had. And I mean, once we came out of lockdown, you were talking to people in braai gatherings, and if you're jogging with your friend, then the chat started to shift towards, so what are you invested in at the moment, which was quite interesting. So the rise of the retail investor was really driven by things like digital transformation. So if you're looking at digital platforms like the Cetrix Now, having lowered barriers to entry, which really enabled broader demographic to actually participate in investing. There's also been a great rise in education and accessibility as well. So there's a growing need for financial education to empower new investors, particularly in understanding traditional investment vehicles. So I always say to my colleagues is that in the investment world, sometimes we're trying to sell a product that a lot of people don't understand. So the education part is quite important and shows like the one that I'm in right now actually helping this. And I think product innovation as well has been key with the rise in index tracking and ETFs, which suggests a shift in investor preference as well, prompting financial institutes to innovate and offer products that actually align with these trends. So looking at data, I mean, in the US, we saw in the year 2022, index tracking funds, or other people might call it passive funds, those surpassed actively managed funds for the first time ever in 2022. In fact, in the US, the split between those two is around 50%, which is quite massive, a massive growth in index tracking or rules-based funds. And retail investors have also taken part in that growth, investing in ETFs, and they hold around 25% of US stocks. In Europe, the retail client base is increased as well in terms of the share in the market. I think it's about 15%. Can't recall for which year. So with online platforms pulling in over 10 million accounts last year, 2024. And there has been a great rise as well in growth amongst young investors. And in South Africa as well, massive rise in DIY investing. Indexation is around 10%, which is quite low in South Africa when you compare that to the US. So there's still quite a big room there for growth in South Africa, even though the adaptation of indexation or rule-based funds has been accelerated in the past few years.
Yep, retail investors, a topic close to my heart as well, obviously, although plenty of institutions do also read ghost mail, but I always have a soft spot for retail investors. And it's great to see those who have kind of made it through the past few years and survived the volatility and have realized this is actually much harder than it initially looked. Those who then push through and carry on learning are the ones who really achieve wealth creation over their lifetime. So well done. Well done to them. And of course, the people listening to this podcast firmly fit into that category. Otherwise, they wouldn't be listening. So yeah, last question for this episode, which I've really enjoyed, I must say. How has Satrix performed over this 5-year period?
Yeah, so it's quite exciting to be part of Satrix because it has been, it's done quite well. And as expected in a period where indexation or rules-based investing has attracted attention and seen flows over the years. So we grew from managing 106 billion assets under management at the end of 2019 to our close to 250 billion now at the end of March. And from the products we have put out to the market, we have seen quite a lot of increase in offshore allocations, actually. So if you're looking at our ETFs, I think we've got about 38 ETFs listed on the JSE, and you're looking at the assets under management of those ETFs, 60% of those actually our offshore ETFs. So investors looking for more diversification and also more innovation in terms of the types of products that are out there and listed on the JSE. And of those 117 listed ETFs on the JSE, we close to about 35% market share of the market cap of those ETFs. And just looking at collective investment scheme flows across the ASISA categories, and if we exclude money market and commodity ETFs and look at the data up to December 2024, we saw net inflows where 35 of those inflows going into indexation. If you're looking at the past 60 months or 5 years, from that 35% of those net inflows, Satrix pulled in about 40% of that. And then back to my point of more flows into indexation on rule-based funds, if you look at the last 3 years, the net flows into such funds were 50%. So quite an increase of the share in the net inflows. And again, Satrix took 40% off that. But in 2024, last year, it was quite a very good year for indexation, where those funds, they took close to 90% of net inflows into those collective investment scheme funds. And Satrix, being the market leader in this front, took half of those inflows, showing a remarkable trust from our clients, and both from the retail side and also the institutional clients, which we were really appreciative of Ghost.
Those are fantastic numbers. So congratulations, Sia, and to the team at Satrix. I mean, it hardly surprises me, having worked with so many of the team members there and seeing the level of care and certainly just passion for the markets, I think, and for the investors who are empowered through products like those offered by Satrix. We're going to have to bring it to a close there. We've had a lot of fun on this one, a lot of really good data. I'll try and include quite a few of those tables in the transcript. So if you've listened to this in your car or jogging or at the gym or whatever it is you're doing, and you'd like to go and see those tables, there will be a couple of them available on the Ghostmail website where you can find this podcast as well. Sia, thank you. And thanks for all the effort on pulling the data for this show. It was quite a bit of work, and I think it was very, very cool. Of course, you've set the standard now, so now I expect all these data-driven shows going forward. You see, this is the problem. This is why I'm bad at making the bed. If you're good at it, then you have to do it every day. But if you're just objectively bad at it, then you don't have to. So you've now proven an incredible ability to make the bed. And this is now our expectation going forward, eh? All these great stats.
Yes, okay. No pressure. Thanks, Ghost, and thanks to your loyal listeners as well. I hope this recording will shed some light in understanding some concepts. They may have been not understood very well, and get to know what has been happening in the market as well in the last 5 years or so. You know, market volatility will always be there, and people are in it for the long term while striking a nice balance in terms of diversification in their portfolio. They should be all right. So till next time, Ghost. Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you, Sia. Ciao. Satrix Investments Pty Limited and Satrix Managers RF Pty Limited are authorized financial services providers. Nothing you have heard in this podcast should be construed as advice. Please do your own research and visit the Satrix website for more information on all their ETF products.